Hi there, Jonathan here. The following talk is offered freely to ensure that no one is ever denied access to these practices and to these teachings. If you feel inspired to make a donation to support this offering, you can go to my website where you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter designed to support you in your practice. That's at www.jonathanfaust.com. Thank you and enjoy. I realized something about two-thirds of the way through that meditation, just how exhausted I am. Anyone else notice that? When you realize, like, oh man, I am depleted. So maybe I'll just do like a silent third eye transmission, you know, for the next. Let's take care of that. So tonight's talk is on determination and resolution. It's the eighth of the 10 perfections. I was just out in Colorado with some friends on an annual jaunt that we do, and knew I had this talk coming up. So I asked my two friends, I said, has there ever been a time when you thought you really wanted something and you gave it all that you had, only to find out that you didn't really want it? And one friend said almost immediately, the first 40 years of my life. So these 10 perfections, and again, every time I mention them, I balk a little bit at the word perfection, because it has this sense of, if you're not there, you're not perfect. But they are considered, they're qualities of wakefulness. And as you reflect on these qualities and cultivate these qualities, they have a way of clarifying and purifying the heart and mind. So just to review the first seven, the first is cultivating a generous heart. And as you know, when you feel generous, it's a shift in consciousness. You know, it's very hard to feel generous and angry at the same time. They don't really coexist. So that's the very foundation, is cultivating that sense of generosity, because that's what sets the field of moving you from a tightly bound little self to a self that's in relationship with the world. The second, as you cultivate a generous heart, is to reflect on your behavior, your ethical behavior, you know, around non-harming, around social justice, around equality. And again, when you cultivate those qualities, they bring out a quality of selflessness. And they you engage in the world from a really beautiful and pure place. The third is referred to as renunciation. And that is really looking at how you can simplify your life. To look at all the ways your life is complicated with unnecessary things, and how the more you can simplify your life, the more clarity you bring into your life. And that leads to wisdom, to your capacity to see what's true, to see through your embellishments and your stories and your preferences, to begin to come in contact with reality. If you engage into this practice of cultivating an open heart and reflecting on your moral behavior and simplifying and seeing more clearly, the next quality you need to cultivate is having energy and vitality, to really have the firepower to stay present in this world, which is not designed to support you in being awake. This entire practice is described as swimming upstream. So you need fuel in the tank. And part of that is looking at at your physical health, but looking at your mental attitude, how to stay positive and to look for the good. Along with the energy that you're cultivating, you also need to cultivate patience, to really trust that as you're engaged in this life, that there's a natural flow to how your life evolves and how everything that's between you and feeling free, how it unwinds. So it's like staying the course, energetic but patient at the same time. And then that brings in a deeper recognition of truth and cultivating truthfulness, to see truth but also to speak the truth. And then that leads to determination, that is the capacity to stay the course. The Dalai Lama said, there is no getting around these essential ingredients: determination, effort, and time. And these are the real secrets to happiness. So it's about having a sense of staying with what you know is most important, giving it good effort, but also trusting there's an unfolding that occurs in your life. And it's been said that it's only this quality of determination in your life that can completely fulfill all the other mental perfections. When you have determination, you can make decisions more clearly. You have kind of an unwavering in your decisions. You overcome hesitation in your life. And you can cultivate a sense of persistence. So it has a lot to do with willpower, but there's another side to it. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the importance of, first of all, knowing what you want. It's one thing to climb a ladder really fast, but it's also important to make sure the ladder is on the right wall. It's important to kind of set your course, and then cultivating that sense of determination. There's a lot of studies now on grit. So cultivating grit in your life. And then, again, remembering what you most want, how to cultivate balance in all of this. So according to the legend of the Buddha, before the Buddha's final enlightenment, he declared this. He said, "Let the blood and flesh of the body dry up. Let the skin and sinews fall from the bones. I will not leave this seat before having attained enlightenment." To me, that sounds pretty grim. And there's an interesting paradox in here, that when we explore what wakefulness means, we tend to think of willpower and determination as this, it's just this grim fight uphill the whole time. That's one element, but there's another element of wakefulness, of non-judging awareness, of allowing. It's also part of the unfolding of the path. So knowing what you want. I ran across this story that kind of speaks of to the kind of the power of determination. I didn't know this about Helen Keller. People all over the world know the story of Helen Keller, the deaf-blind girl Annie Sullivan taught to communicate by spelling letters on her hands, whose story was depicted in the play and the movie The Miracle Worker. What most people don't know is the story of how Helen's parents found Annie Sullivan in the first place. Helen's mother, Kate, who happened to be a cousin of Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general, had been inspired by a story of the successful education of another deaf blind girl, Laura Bridgman, which she read in Charles Dickens' American Notes. So in 1886, she and Helen's father, Arthur, traveled from their home in Alabama to Baltimore to find Dr. J. Julian Chisholm for advice. He, in turn, referred them to Alexander Graham Bell, the one who invented the telephone, who was working with deaf children at the time. He, in turn, advised them to contact the Perkins Institute for the Blind, where Laura Bridgman herself had been educated. So they traveled to Boston and found Michael Ananagos, the school's director, who asked a former student, Annie Sullivan, to become Helen's teacher. If you pause for a moment to consider all the obstacles Arthur and Kate Keller had to overcome and to find and follow this convoluted path to Annie Sullivan in the late 1800s, no less, we're led to conclude that they must have had an abundance of the very same stuff that enabled Helen herself not only to learn to communicate, but also become the first blind person to earn a Bachelor's of Arts degree at Radcliffe, and to read Braille, not only in English, but also French, German, Greek, and Latin, and to write and publish. That's determination. And I'm sure as you reflect back over your life, there were times when you really, really wanted something. And do you remember what it was like to sacrifice to make it happen? Whether it was a degree or a job or a relationship or a project that you really wanted to complete. There's something here about feeling the desire for an outcome and then feeling the possibility of it and then mobilizing yourself to move in that direction. And of course, what gets in the way is fear, lack of energy, the lack of courage. And as each of us is finding our own path, there are a lot of obstacles that get in the way. First, you have to contend with your desire to be liked and your desire to fit in, which can oftentimes cut you off from your true calling. We tend to defer to our primary caretakers or our culture to tell us what we really want. We also desire security, so we may tend to compromise on what we really want in order to have that sense of security and to fit in. But at some point, there's a wake-up call where you ask yourself, what do I really want? How much of my desires are just programmed in me? How much am I living out the life that my primary caretakers told me I wanted, or I decided I wanted when I was young? And that's all part of the journey, is getting really, really clear what you want. And in all of these talks, in the 10 Perfections and beyond, I keep coming back to the same thing. You know, what do you really, really want? What is your highest intention? The other thing I mentioned, of course, so you might as well get out of the way, is that you're going to die. At least your body will. But that actually helps you clarify your intention. What do you most want? So usually what we most want, it's not 100% true, but usually what we really want, it doesn't come easily or automatically. It requires some effort in order to move in that direction, whatever it may be. And so we set the course. I've shared this story before. I don't think I've shared it in a while. But I lived in an ashram for many, many years and had very idealistic, a really idealistic sense of what this life would be if I gave it a full-time shot, of yoga and selfless service and meditation and all that stuff. And in our community, we all did yoga together, starting at like 5 or 5:30 in the morning. And so in a very dark room with like a candle, we'd be guided through different postures. And and we were always looking for different ways we could sort of inspire ourselves in the practice. So one of the teachers decided it'd be really, really cool in the middle of our practice to ring a bell and then read something from some yogic scripture, So we were all going up into the headstand, and we're all kind of like holding the posture and breathing, and the bell rang, and what he read was something like this. And I say unto you, to take human form is rare, and to take human form and be exposed to the Dharma, to the truth, is even rarer. And to engage in the practice is rarer still. And out of those who dedicate their lives to awakening, only one in every 500 years will fully awaken. there's this long pause. And the back of the room, this little upside-down voice said, "Gee, thanks, that's encouraging." And that was followed by a sound I had never heard before and may never hear again, which was the sound of about 80 people collapsing out of the headstand and just giggling heaps on the floor. So the idea of awakening is rather lofty. But whatever you want in your life, chances are you really had to hang in there. You know, if you just think about, you know, a project or a degree or whatever it was, you had to call on some kind of determination. So then part of the question is, well, what is the alchemy of determination? How do you stay engaged in your life with what you most want? And there are really three things. One of them is to care about the goal passionately. So that what you really, really want, you deeply care about it. And that keeps your heart alive and awake. The second is to ignore the odds against you. There are all these amazing stories of people who just did that one thing that they really, really loved and navigated their way to a career or whatever. So you kind of have to, if you think of only one in every 500 years, that's a pretty depressing way to engage into your practice. But if you care passionately about being more awake in your life, that's fuel. So to care about the goal, to ignore the odds, and the third is to prepare to endure. That is to really understand that there is a quality of endurance that is necessary with anything you want that's really important to you. So caring about the goal, again, is a way of engaging your heart. It's one thing to say, I'd like to make a lot of money. But when you're tapped into the why, I'd like to have a lot of money so I can care for my family. I'd like to make a lot of money so that I can share it with others and promote them and their dreams and their lives. You get a sense of how different it is when you're really tapped into the why. The why you're doing something will connect you with your heart. So I recently did an interview with Tammy Simon, who's the founder of Sounds True, and for her podcast called Meetings at the Edge, which is a terrific podcast, by the way. We may have lowered the standards a little bit with our recent interview, but she was interviewing me about a 6.5-hour audio course I did for Sounds True last year called Body-Centered Inquiry. And at the end, she was saying, you know, this really is a book. You know, we would love to work with you on this. And it once again triggered my passion around writing the book, which, of course, immediately triggers all the blocks to it, you know, all the anxiety and all the fear and so forth. But if I remember the why, that why you would write a book, that if it could truly be helpful for someone, I immediately connect up with the heart, and I can feel the passion flowing through that whole project. So with whatever you want in your life, it's very helpful to ask yourself, why do I want this? And to really open to kind of the felt sense of that. Chances are that will help to fuel all the determination and grit and endurance it's going to require to keep moving toward that. And so then it comes to developing grit, developing endurance. A little story I ran across recently. I was a year out of college and working for an ad agency that paid me at the poverty line to really just wear short skirts and flirt with clients. I split an apartment with three other girls, bartended at night, to rise above the poverty line and had fun. I ran to stay in shape. It's generally still thought of marathoners as one sandwich short of a picnic or a hammer short of a full toolkit, or assume the wheel was spinning but the hamster was dead. But still I admire them from far away. The day of the 1996 Boston Marathon, I had steered clear of the city. Then, after the event was well over, I met up with friends for drinks at a bar near the finish line. It was a memorably stressful evening as I had to decide Corona with a lime or without. As dark set in, my friend and I were an hour deep in the drinking and eating. And I happened to glance out the window and notice a woman running down Boylston Street. What caught my attention was that she had some major physical challenges, not to mention she was probably in her late 60s. It's difficult to explain how she was running, but it was as if she was hopping forward on one foot, paused, and then dragged her other foot in line. The foot being dragged looked as if it had no ability to hold weight or that it was possibly paralyzed. Regardless, I remember being impressed she was going out for a run at such a busy time of the evening and thinking it must take her an hour to run a mile and wasn't that uncomfortable. But as she got closer, an aching sensation spread through my insides. She had a number on, a Boston Marathon bib pinned to her shirt. Now, when I say the marathon was over, I mean over. The cheering crowds had evaporated, police presence was gone, the finish line was dismantled, aid stations long since packed up. The marathon course had been open to traffic for quite a while. What was thought to be the last runner had crossed the finish line hours beforehand, hours. But here she was, this warrior of a woman with a significant disability, had started her day in Hoppington and was finally two blocks from the finish. I'm sure the last 13 miles, if not more, had been devoid of aid stations. I'm sure as she ran through the center of Wellesley, no one even knew she was in the race. Just a woman out for a slow, slow jog. And here's what went down next. Maggie, that woman is running. So? No, I mean running, as in the marathon. It can't be, it's over. But she has a number on. Look. Oh my God, she's still running the marathon? After about 30 seconds of stunned silence, we threw money on the table and sprinted out the door onto Boylston. Maggie went to one side of her and I to the other. We started clapping, cheering, and shouting and crying hard as the Niagara Falls down the sides of our faces. The woman nodded in acknowledgement and carried on. Over the course of those remaining blocks, the other people on the street began to understand what was going on and joined our cheering squad. And honest to God, we became a random group of 18 to 20 sobbing strangers jogging next to her. We never got her name. She wasn't talkative at the end and she just wanted to go home. But she gently but firmly pushed away our offer to help her home. It seemed obvious she wasn't out there for the glory and the recognition. She was out there to finish what she started. Her other motivations we'll never know. It's easy for us to glorify elite athletes and marvel at that talent. But I've been around endurance racing enough to know that the people who work the hardest, who experience the most suffering and have to dig the deepest and overcome the biggest obstacles, are not those who come in first, but in many cases, those who come in last. And while I don't know who our mystery runner was, I want everyone to know she existed and what she accomplished that day. There's something about witnessing people who sacrifice so deeply for what they want that touches all of us. In that same way, when you can bring that quality to what you most want, it will transform your life. So I spoke earlier of the different forms of practice, the different forms you can cultivate wakefulness. One of them is concentration. It's a certain amount of grit that's required in concentration, about staying present on one simple focal point. Mind wanders, you bring it back. Another is developing your capacity to be the witness, to simply see what's present without grasping or pushing away. A third quality is the quality of surrender, of just simply being in that sense of presence. There's one particular meditation technique I wanted to share with you briefly, and we'll talk a little bit more about grit before we end. But this practice of determination is referred to as aditan. And there is a particular form of meditation that's called the aditan meditation, or the sitting of strong determination. And I thought it might be interesting for us just to do a few minutes of this practice. Now, the technique is relatively simple. And for this, just to really get the full benefit of it, you might sit up nice and straight. And as you're ready, you can close your eyes. And I'm going to give you some specific instructions. Your practice is to bring your attention to the rim of the nostrils and notice the flow of breath happening right here. The second instruction is not to move an unnecessary muscle. So your body is perfectly still. The focal point is the breath at the rim of the nostrils. You'll feel the natural movement of the breath, but otherwise, let your body be absolutely still. We're sharing these words from the Buddha. As a mountain, a rock, stable and firmly based, does not tremble in rough winds, but remains precisely in its own place, so you too must be constantly stable in resolute determination, going on to the perfection of determination, you will attain self-awakening. Just for the next minute, awareness at the rim of the nostrils, body perfectly still. And with your eyes closed, you might release the technique and simply feel the effect, feel the imprint. If you like, you can deepen the breath and feel free to open the eyes, or if you like, you can remain with them closed. So this sitting of strong determination, the Adityan meditation, you may have found it really riveting your attention, or you may have found it impossible to do, or maybe alternating back and forth between the two. It can be a very powerful technique. I've done retreats where we'll do that practice for 1 hour a day. So you can imagine what that's like. Maybe you can't. I'm not sure I can, except for I've had the experience of sitting with the intention not to move an unnecessary muscle. There have been times in that practice where I feel like it really cultivates that sense of the witness. You know, the recognition that everything is changing, you know, and I am just the awareness of all that's happening. A lot of times it's just unbelievably excruciating. But it can be a helpful practice at times, maybe just to kind of include that in your set, to sit with that intention not to move. It can be quite riveting. But I think you'll find if you lengthen the time, it requires a tremendous amount of determination to stay with that practice. And I have to say, on the retreats that I have done that have been the concentration retreats, where it's just all about one pointed focus, it's quite transforming. Your mind gets very, very calm. So something comes out of that. There's a fruit that comes out of that, that intense determination. So I wanted to talk a little bit about grit and about determination, because it can be quite helpful. There's a woman by the name of Angela Duckworth who did a TED Talk on grit. And she did this study where she was studying people who are just entering West Point and trying to determine who are going to be the ones who are going to go through the really rigorous basic training that they have, which is designed to really eliminate a lot of people. But then she took this same kind of protocol and applied it to, well, what about people who are really good at spelling bees, you know, where you really have to focus to get good at that. And then she brought it into teachers, you know, who are the teachers who are going to survive? And what she recognized was that to be successful in life didn't have a lot to do with looking good. It didn't have much to do with social intelligence. It didn't have a whole lot to do even with IQ. But the most successful people were the ones who were able to tap into what she called grit. And that is perseverance and passion for long-term goals. She said the difference is, it's the difference between running a marathon and running a sprint. It's a sense of knowing what you want as a long-term goal and whatever it takes to stay with your practice. So there are a couple qualities that she has said were important. One is courage. That is to say, knowing that you're going to fail over and over again. There's this wonderful phrase from yoga philosophy that says that it's better to fail at your own path than it is to succeed at someone else's path. So just that recognition, the courage to know that you're going to fail. The second quality is being conscientious. And there's a distinction there between being dependable and being achievement-oriented. And so what she says is better to be a racehorse than a donkey. So it's not about necessarily about being conscientious to kind of fit in, but being conscientious toward your goals, staying focused on what you want in life. Another quality is following through, like you're practicing with purpose. Another is the quality of cultivating optimism and confidence. And again, this brings us back to the mental perfection of energy. You keep your energy up by cultivating a quality of confidence. And she said that people who cultivate grit, that they believe that everything will be all right in the end. And if it's not all right, it's not the end. It's pretty cool. And the fifth is excellence versus perfection. Perfection means you're meeting someone else's standards. Excellence means you're meeting your own standards. And so these are the qualities that we need to cultivate. No matter whether your goals are around job or profession or relationship, or they're more about increasing your capacity for happiness or non-judging awareness or whatever that may be, knowing that the practice requires courage, that you're going to stumble and fail. Being conscientious, remembering the long-term goal, cultivating a quality of optimism, and a quality of excellence. We used to always say in the ashram that company is stronger than willpower, and it's an important part of cultivating what you most want as well, to be around those who inspire you, those who want what you want. Shinryo Suzuki, the great Zen meditation master, used to talk about how there are three kinds of racehorses. That there's one racehorse that the jockey just thinks of going faster, and the horse will go faster. And the second kind of racehorse is that as soon as the jockey just taps the flank of the horse, it'll speed up. And the third racehorse is the one where the jockey's got to like wail on the horse a little bit to get it going. And he says, well, which of these racehorses would you like to be? So we all want to be the first horse. But he said it's actually the third horse is the one that cultivates the most compassion. And what I've also found is that the third horse are always the best teachers because they're the ones who really struggled. So remembering that when you're struggling in your practice, that compassion is so important. We tend to think of determination as something really grim. But when you're in it for the long run, cultivating a sense of compassion for yourself is very, very important. And it really leads to, just in our final few minutes here, this sense of balance. Tara, my wife, tells a story of how she's a type A meditator. And, you know, in the ashram she lived in, you know, she got up an hour early to get there before everyone else. And she'd always seek out teachers and say, you know, here are all the practices I'm doing. You know, well, what do you think I should do to, like, amp it up a little more? And to a fault, every teacher would say, you might consider relaxing. And she'd go, oh, yeah, relax. Yeah, and then she'd write that down as a one more thing to put on her list. And it really, it's so important, I think, to reflect on what you most want and the skillful ways of arriving. There's the classic story of Ananda, who was the Buddha's cousin, who was his attendant. And after the Buddha's passing, there was a gathering of all the arahants, or all those who had like been fully awakened. And he was considered not there yet, because he was so busy kind of organizing. And so he decided, kind of as the Buddha did, you know, I will not move from this seat until I am fully awakened. I guess he really wanted to go to that meeting. And so he practiced diligently, you know, all through the night. And he didn't arrive there. And so he finally just said, I give up. And he just lay down. And then he was awakened. We have to find the balance. It's very, very easy. And I would imagine every one of us at different times falls into some grim sense of determination. You know, I'm going to whip myself into shape. You know, we perform some kind of violence toward ourselves. So it's very important to ask yourself, what do I most want? So we had that practice of the Aditan practice, the sitting of strong determination, which was about precise focus and to be fully, fully present in the here and now. And we'll close with a little meditation with a contrast to that, which is another quality of wakefulness, a quality of simple open awareness. So before we close with this little meditation, I think the questions that really we each need to consider first is, what do you really, really want? How badly do you want it? What are you willing to sacrifice to get it? And what would most support you in moving toward that? So if you like, let's close our eyes. We'll take a moment just to kind of explore a little contrast here in practice from willful effort to resting in presence. So you might again draw your attention to the rim of the nostrils. How intimately can you track the subtle flow of air right to these little patches of skin? Let your body be perfectly still. Can you sense this quality of one pointed determination? When the mind loses focus, immediately reapply it. And you might now release that technique and allow yourself to investigate what could soften or relax or let go. Is there anything in the mind or body that could relax or let go right now? Can you feel or imagine the space inside your body? Can you feel or imagine the space outside your body? Can you imagine the space inside your body and the space outside your body as one vast, unified space? Can you imagine this perception of space as effortless? Can you imagine this space infused with a quality of kindness, immeasurable kindness? Can you imagine the immeasurable quality of compassion for yourself and others? Can you imagine this space imbued with the quality of joy? The quality of effortless allowing. And gently deepening your breath. Feeling the breath and noticing the sounds, the aliveness of the moment. And when you're ready, you can deepen the breath and let the eyes open. So cultivating determination can have a hard edge to it. There's a quality of discipline that's enormously helpful. But there's also a quality of allowing. As a great teacher once said, is it not true that what you most want is not already here in some form? This is the delicate balance that we're walking here. So thank you for your kind attention. A couple quick announcements before we move on. I'm going to be traveling teaching this month. So we've got next week there'll be no class, July 4th. And then we will have Michelle Fisher will be here.